All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. My name is Karen Von Hippel, and on behalf of the Global Development Commons at USAID and CSIS, I'd like to welcome you here this afternoon for this event. We're very excited to talk about open innovation for government today. In our project, the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project, we have been working on ways of introducing user-driven approaches to innovation to enhance development assistance and deal with some really difficult development challenges. And this can include anything from open competitions to really move beyond the usual suspects to solve challenges through to almost organized brainstorming sessions where you borrow ideas from adjacent fields and other fields. So there are a lot of really exciting things that are going on right now, and we're looking forward today to hearing about the new U.S. government approach of the new Obama administration, which is committed to open government through transparency, participation, and collaboration, and they're all essential tools for fostering innovation. Today, what I'd like to do is just I'll briefly outline the format, and then I'll introduce the speakers. What we'll do is we'll hear brief presentations from each of our expert speakers. They all work in different parts of the U.S. government. And then we will have a sort of a brief question period that I'll moderate, and then I'll open it up to the floor. Everyone should also know that we are streaming this event live on the Global Development Commons site, which is www.globaldevelopmentcommons.net. So if you're interested and you're watching this through that stream, you should go to the website and follow the blog post to the homepage to this webcast. It's also going to appear on usstream.tv on the Global Development Commons channel. For those of you who are watching and want to participate, we really are looking forward to your ideas. It's a great way to influence policy, and we will try to integrate some of the questions from the folks watching on the webcast later during the discussion period, assuming this works. It's an innovation for us here to try this. We've never done this before. So we will also have a podcast that will be available tomorrow, so anyone can download that if they'd like to learn more or share this with your friends. So let me just quickly introduce our speakers in order. First, we're going to hear from Beth Novick from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. She is leading the office's open government work. She's a professor of law and director of the Institute for Information Law and Policy at New York Law School. She's an expert on intellectual property, innovation, and constitutional law, as well as on e-government and e-democracy. She'll be followed by Doug Comstock, who is the director of the Innovative Partnership Program at NASA. And he is, his program provides, get ready for this, leverage technology for NASA's mission directorates, programs, and projects through investments and technology partnerships with industry, academia, government agencies, and national laboratories. So we're looking forward to hearing how that works. Then we'll hear from Jeremy Curtin on my right. He is a coordinator for international information programs at the Department of State. He has been coordinating this office since 2007. Previously, he was in the Office of Public Diplomacy for 3 years. And then finally, we'll hear from Karen Turner, who is the acting director of the Global Development Commons at USAID. She has responsibility for private sector alliance building, liaison with the Millennium Challenge Corporation, and relationships with bilateral and multilateral institutions. I think, as you all know, the Global Development Commons is a new initiative to promote innovation in international development through knowledge-sharing partnerships and collaborative problem-solving. So without further ado, let's start with Beth. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. I want to thank you for organizing and for having me here today. It's really quite an honor, particularly because we are really at the beginning of what I hope is an exciting new era in innovation in government, in which the President has committed through a memorandum on the second day in office on January 21st to create a government that is more transparent, participatory, and collaborative in particular. And I think that that's something that we're going to hear a lot about today, is what those innovations are that are already taking place and how we might do more of them and really replicate and scale the work that's being done by people on this panel today. So the administration is very much committed to, as the President said on that day when he signed the memo, he said, "Let me say as simply as I can, transparency and the rule of law will be the touchstones of this presidency." So openness and a new spirit, a new way of doing things is really, I think, the hallmark. We saw it reflected in the work in the campaign and the level of engagement, the unprecedented level of engagement that took place in electing this administration, in the fact that in the transition, this administration for the very first time had a policy working group not only on the usual topics of the economy and energy and immigration, but also on the subject of technology, innovation, and government reform. And I had the great honor to be a part of and serve as part of that committee that really looked at how we can bring innovation to the institutions of government in order to create more effective government. And so now has begun a process, a kind of listening and learning process of crafting recommendations, work that's going on, taking place between OSTP, OMB, GSA, in conversation with the agencies now, of thinking about how we can actually realize this bold commitment, how we can take this bold vision of creating a more effective, more open government, and effect practical recommendations to bring that work to the ground, to make it real, and to bring it to scale. And again, I think that's why I'm just glad to be here to listen and learn and hear what's already taking place. Because the work will be very hard. It's not something that we will accomplish in 120 days. We don't finish on May 21st. We essentially start at this point of trying to figure out how we enter this new era of taking the new technologies that are available, the social networking tools that are available, the internet-based tools that are available, the new strategies and processes that we're hearing about in order to make public policy in better and more effective ways. We have for so long, and by necessity, as a result of the communications environment in which we live, had to make policy very much behind closed doors among small groups of experts and without the benefit of the opportunity now to listen to and to learn from and to work with a much wider array of people in the public, in the public sector, in between the public and the private sector. And so we have missed an opportunity, really, or just begun to have the opportunity now to realize the chance to connect the intelligence of the many out there with the work of the few that take place here in government and here in Washington. So today we have these new technologies that are now available to us, and the question is, what are the strategies, legal, political, technological, cultural, that can help us to take advantage of the opportunities that we see emerging today? We know that people write newspapers together, they write encyclopedias together, they write software code together. Employees in the private sector are connecting via social networks to generate innovations for their firms, and we are just beginning to explore, I think, the way in which we can do more of that and to do that better in government, so that we are connecting amateurs outside the boundaries of one institution, whether it's outside the boundaries of one agency or outside the boundaries of government, to the private sector, how we are creating the kinds of connections that I think folks here on the panel are actively already engaged in, to improve the quality of expertise in government, to improve the core missions of the agencies, and really to do the work of government even more effectively. We, of course, have a tremendously talented and effective government workforce already. The question is what we can do more of now to enable the collaboration that will make us more effective, that will reduce cost, that will reduce duplication of effort, and that will allow us really to work better with the wiki army, if you will, of the American citizenry, of the global citizenry, to inform the way we make decisions. So we need and are very much committed to looking at ways we can bring innovation to the core work of policymaking. And the three values that really the president has set out, the approach of looking at transparency, participation, and collaboration, these as really foundational qualities to inform how we rethink the way in which we make policy in the 21st century and the kind of government that we would like to have. Let me just say a few words about what those three values mean and where I think we need to take some of this work. So transparency, of course, is both about the President's memorandum talks about both opening government data and the operations of government to the public, not simply for its own sake, but in order to hold government more accountable, in order to enable that wiki army of citizen regulators, if you will, to enable citizen engagement and participation, we have to first have transparency. And this also helps to open up new economic opportunity. When we look at, and I think we'll again hear more about this, when we look at the ways in which government data has in fact driven the creation of things like the GPS industry, the internet mapping industries, the genomics industry, all of this wouldn't be possible without the release of government data. So we see now efforts being taken in this direction already just in the first few months of this administration with the launch of recovery.gov, an unprecedented step towards greater transparency into the recovery and our economic policy, the Attorney General's release of the FOIA memo a month later that really affects a complete sea change in the way that we look at the release of government information, and the discussions now about the creation of data.gov, a website that will actually be a repository for the release and download of government information that the CIO Council is actively working on and which we'll see coming soon. Again, transparency is a driver of participation and engagement. It's a way of getting better information back into informed decision-making in government, and it means that we must be committed to creating new and effective early opportunities for citizen engagement and participation. OMB, just in the last few weeks, launched the first-ever public comment process on an executive order to invite public comment on the process of defining what should be our regulatory review strategy. There have been ongoing opportunities for engagement, whether it's rulemaking and e-rulemaking or science advisory boards and fellow advisory committees, and we are now looking at how we actually modernize these and take advantage of using new technology to bring greater expertise from a wider array of actors into government. The White House launched Open for Questions last month, the virtual town hall, and is engaged in similar kinds of public outreach and engagement opportunities. These are, I think, important steps in that they really signal a sea change, a willingness to not only inform the public and put information out there, but to listen to the public, to take information in, and to use technology to do so. And finally, let me just say collaboration, which I think we'll hear most about today, the idea of working together to solve problems, or as the president has talked about, he uses the language of all hands on deck, the need to really work together to solve the enormous problems that confront us. So whether it's work being done out of the Department of Defense to create social networking technologies that connect experts to one another, or the work going on at State or TSA on connecting employees to the central administration to generate ideas and innovations, or it's work that we're thinking about how we connect better with the private sector to enable help with developing new initiatives, with solving problems, and getting essentially all hands on deck to devise solutions to the challenges. This means we have to do a lot better job on the .gov side of articulating the problems and challenges that face us, of framing the questions so that people can bring their answers to the table and collaborate and participate in the co-creation of government and the co-creation of policy. So we have a lot of work set out ahead of us, and I think it will be very inspiring to hear from the folks who've already been doing it, which I'm really looking forward to doing, because I think the best thing that we can do is to listen to them and to hear how they did what they did, whether because of or in spite of the conditions under which they were working. And I hope that they will say a bit more about what your own understanding and definition has been of innovation in your agencies, how you've seen yourself and your own work as furthering the core mission of the agency, particularly in the area of policymaking, and making the agency more effective at doing its core mission of making policy. I think also to speak a little bit to the question of what have been the cultural barriers and opportunities that have given rise to the work that you have created. And they may, again, be barriers or opportunities, depending on I've heard both sides of the story from different people. But the question is, how do we replicate and create more of you doing more work like this, I think, around the government? And finally, I would just also ask to everyone on the panel, what is it that the White House, that from a centralized perspective, that the administration can do in helping to really create the impetus, create the encouragement, remove the barriers that will help to create a culture of innovation across the government so that we are creating, hopefully, a more effective government characterized by transparency, participation, and collaboration. Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Beth. I think you posed some great challenges, and perhaps our three subsequent speakers can maybe address those questions after they do their presentations when we start the question and answer period. And perhaps you can be thinking as well about the some of the challenges you will anticipate yourself in trying to achieve that across the government, because it is an extraordinary change moving from probably one of the more closed governments we've ever had to this very open, transparent system. So we're looking forward to that. Doug.
Thanks, Karen. Thanks, Beth. And it's a pleasure to be here to share with you some of the things that we've been doing at NASA with regards to innovation and open innovation and tapping into some sources that we might not through our normal means of business to help the agency address its needs. And first, let me talk a little bit about innovation and the difference between technology and innovation. And innovation is really taking technology and putting it to work and, some practical application. And that's what we try to do within NASA. I'm the director of the Innovative Partnerships Program, And we work with all sorts of partners to sort of be a clearinghouse for technology within NASA. And we basically match technology needs and technology capabilities, and the technology movement can be in both directions, into the agency and out of the agency. We work to bring a lot of technology in through a number of different means, and I'll talk about some of those, to address the technology needs that we have for our space missions and in aeronautics and in exploration. And we also are the technology transfer organization within NASA to take all the technologies that NASA develops in our pursuit of space and aeronautics missions and then look for other applications of those to the public. And we produce a publication annually called Spinoff, which documents 40 to 50 of the top examples of some of those technology transfer successes for that year. So we have offices at all 10 of the NASA field centers and folks who work that technology in both directions and really try to effect innovation to help NASA with our needs and then take the technologies that NASA has developed and then look for innovation for other applications in the public and in the healthcare industry and industrial productivity and many, many other applications. So we really work it in both directions. So it's a benefit not only for our mission but also in general to return value to the taxpayer through putting the technologies that they paid for to work in other applications and improving health and quality of life and so on. So what are some of the sources of innovation for doing this? And as was mentioned in the intro and came up for air finally on that, we work with all sorts of different partners, large businesses, small businesses, other government agencies, and universities. And in particular, there's some new activities that we started in our Centennial Challenges Prize Program that reaches out to what we call the citizen inventor. These are people who we normally wouldn't get access to through NASA's normal means of procurement. And in general, a little different approach to the relationship, the traditional relationship between the government and businesses, which traditionally has been the government as customer and industry as contractor, and trying to get into more of a partnership relationship with that. And one of the good examples of that within NASA is the COTS program, Commercial Orbital Transportation Services, where there are two industrial firms who are developing space launch capabilities that could deliver cargo to the space station. And it's a cooperative, it's actually a Space Act agreement where they're bringing a lot of resources to the table in addition to what NASA's bringing. So it's really a partnership relationship between the government and industry where each side is bringing resources rather than the traditional contract. And SpaceX is one of the firms that's developing their vehicle, and the other is Orbital Sciences. And we're trying that on a smaller scale through partnerships that we do in my office called the Seed Fund, where we have leveraged technology development, and we really try to encourage the partnership aspect of it rather than the contractor-customer relationship, where you know both sides have an interest. There's a common area of interest. All the partners have skin in the game in terms of moving the technology forward. And when everybody who's in a partnership has skin in the game, they tend to pay more attention to it and focus on it and move forward. So we found that that's been a very good model for us. One other example is something with students that we've done recently. And my program in NASA, the Innovative Partnerships Program, has partnered with the Office of Education within NASA with the Conrad Foundation, which was started by Nancy Conrad, who's the widow of Pete Conrad, who was one of the Apollo astronauts. And Pete was always doing innovative things. And Nancy started this foundation to try to reach out to high school students across the country, get them to do innovative things, and just had the second Innovation Summit out in Silicon Valley at Ames Research Center. And they selected the winners for that. But it was a great event that really catalyzed a lot of great innovation from high school students and trying to educate them about, you know, how to actually take their ideas and turn them into innovations that could do something, and educating them about intellectual property and how could they go about protecting their ideas and what are the next steps for how they might raise capital and so on. And so it really went beyond just coming up with a technology idea, but really looking at how you can put that idea to work, and brought in a lot of experts from the business sector and from NASA and technology and so on. But that's another example of how trying to reach out to not only the professional community, but to high school students as well, and you really get them engaged and look at the marriage between technology and business, which is really where innovations come about through putting the technology to work. A big source of innovation for NASA historically has been small businesses through the Small Business Innovation Research Program, SBIR, and there's a companion program called Small Business Technology Transfer, or STTR, which requires the small businesses to partner with a university or a research institution. The idea there is to get the technology out of the research labs and into practice with a small business. And those have been great sources of technology within NASA. Each year we fund 400 or 500 awards for small businesses to develop that technology. And just an example is all of the three spacecraft that are operating on Mars right now, both of the rovers and also the Phoenix lander, have a number of technologies that came out of that small business research program. And many of those technologies are also successfully commercialized and find other applications. And nearly half of the stories that we document in our spinoff publication each year have their origins from some of these small business research activities. So it's a very fertile ground for innovation that addresses NASA's needs and also is successful in terms of commercialization and helps small businesses grow and benefit the economy. Another area where we really look to for innovation within NASA is our civil servants, the folks who are working in the laboratories. And there's been a program that's been part of NASA since the very beginning when NASA was created in 1958 called the Inventions and Contributions Board, or ICB, which recognizes the innovations that are coming out of the NASA researchers and creates cash awards for innovations, and particularly weighing in those innovations and new technologies that have broader application than just NASA. So that's a way to really encourage innovation internal to NASA and has been a part of NASA since the beginning. Another program that we've started recently is the Innovation Ambassador Program, where it's a competitive thing within NASA, and we open it up to civil servants, and we're trying to reach out to other innovative organizations around the country and learn what they're doing and bring some of those ideas back into NASA. And we have a number of excellent candidates, and we hope to be able to announce our first class of NASA Innovation Ambassadors soon, and that's a program that that we hope to continue. And we think it'll be a real good source of ideas and try to create a positive culture within the agency that we celebrate new ideas and new innovations coming into the agency. In terms of trying to provide technology for the public, we transfer our technology and try to achieve innovation that way. We do a lot through licensing of NASA technologies and transfer of technology through partnership agreements and Space Act agreements. I mentioned we document those in spinoff and license, and we've looked at a new mechanism to do that, which in itself is kind of innovative, and it was the first time it was done by the government, which is to have an auction of exclusive rights to government intellectual property. And we had some technology that we patented. It had been in the NASA portfolio for a while. We tried to put that technology to work in the private sector through our normal means, but we didn't have success with that. So we bundled some of those technologies together, partnered with an auction house called Ocean Tomo, which auctions intellectual property. And we had the first ever auction of a government intellectual property last October in Chicago. Made the front page of the Wall Street Journal that day. So that was an innovative way to try to get government technology out and put it to work in the public. So an innovation in itself. And so for things like that, we like to say that NASA doesn't only push boundaries in space, but sometimes here on Earth. Another thing that we try to do, we call participatory exploration, where we try to really engage the public in the things that NASA is doing, not only so that they can be aware of what's going on, but actually contribute to some of these activities that are going on and adding real value to the kinds of things that that we're doing. And there are a number of examples of some participatory exploration that we've got, some examples, and you can look at these on the website. But one example is Stardust, where people can access on the web some of these samples of material that has captured cometary particles on the Stardust mission and go in and examine in very high fidelity some of those images and catalog those. It's a labor-intensive thing, and so the Stardust program has tapped into the people out there in the in the web and basically put them to work at no cost to the government and really making them participate in these kind of activities. And there's other ones called Click Workers that are doing those kind of things, and a mission called Dawn, and also High Rise, where students can help identify where images are going to be taken with the Mars rovers, and a number of other applications that NASA is trying to do through what we call participatory exploration, and really focusing on not just engaging the public, but actually putting them to work to, you know, contribute materially to the missions that we do. And we're doing a lot with trying to use Web 2.0 with Twitter accounts and blogs and things like that. And, of course, the Mars exploration rovers were a huge hit on Twitter, and a lot of people following that. And, and of late, a good friend of mine, Mike Massimino, who's going to be going up on the next Hubble, next shuttle mission to service the Hubble, he just started doing Twittering of his accounts. And I think just in about a week, he's already got 40 or 50,000 followers. So so that's an exciting one. So I think I've already gone over my time a little bit, but just wanted to share with you a few of the things that we're trying to do within NASA to encourage innovation and bring that to benefit NASA and our missions, but also to broadly benefit the public. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Doug. And yeah, I mean, I think scientists are obviously more innovative and more open to sharing information, and so it's great to hear about how that works in the government. And perhaps maybe a direct contrast, parts of the U.S. government haven't found it so easy to be open and to innovate. And I know the State Department and USAID are experimenting with some new ideas, so looking forward to hearing about that. So, Jeremy, over to you.
We can innovate. Diplomats can try. This subject is very important to us right now because we are trying to cope with the Web 2.0 world and new media. My bureau, the Bureau of International Information Programs, has a mission of reaching out to foreign audiences, engaging them on issues of American policy, society, and values. So only a couple of years ago, we would engage through speakers, printed publications, basic brochure websites, very much one-way broadcasting out to them, passing on information. But a couple of years ago, Karen Hughes was the Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy. We did a story for our website. One of our people went down to Panama and wrote about a USAID program, came back, good pictures, everything. It was a fantastic story. And Karen said, well, where's the video? It's all static. And from that, we started to transform our bureau. And within a couple of months, we created a video team, all out of existing resources, I would say. And now we have a very dynamic video presence on our websites. And our objective is to be as interactive as possible, take advantage of new media. So it's a new kind of openness for us. We're always reaching out to the public, but now we realize that in order to compete in the current global information environment, we have to allow them to reach out to us. So we're trying to find the best way to do that. America.gov is our new website. It's our central platform for other programs that we run web chats, we do blogs, we do other kinds of web-based programs. And we also have a team called the Digital Outreach Team, which goes on to other people's websites in Arabic, Urdu, and Persian, and engages in discussions of foreign policy issues. That, for us, is a particular challenge, and it gets to the question of whether, you know, diplomats can be innovative. Because the State Department does tend to be a culture of clearances. Anything we say has to be cleared by about 20 people, at least. And that's just for the noon briefing. But but our people on the digital outreach team don't do that. They operate from known policy, and they say what they know is right. It's actually very tightly controlled, but because they have a talent for sounding conversational, and it is a discussion forum. It's not a telephone conversation. You have time to think about it. You have time to put it up there. But it's the intersection of Web 2.0 user content engagement and policy control. So it's a kind of coherent chaos. And that's what we're trying to stimulate in the department and in our bureau. We have moved very quickly in many directions with new media. And I've found that the key for us has been to let our people go, to give them rein to think about these ideas, give them time to develop them. So we have America.gov. We have Democracy Video Challenge, which is a major public-private partnership that Laurie Brutton, who is in the audience, a new position for us, public outreach. It draws on videos from around the world on the theme of what is democracy. It's still in progress, but using user-generated content. We have mobile technology, which we're trying to develop. We have a program called Connects, which uses Adobe Connect, a multi-point conversation on the Internet. It's a kind of digital video conference on steroids. But it allows us to generate these conversations among our embassies and among people whom the embassies bring in. When Secretary Clinton went to Brussels a couple of weeks ago, did a town hall meeting, we used this technology and our people to connect what she was doing, saying, to 52 embassies around the region. And it expands our reach. It expands the kind of contacts you can have. But it's got to be two-way, and that's what we continually experiment with. You know, we are a government bureaucracy. When we say something, we say it as the State Department. It's not just, you know, Freddie Two Shoes, and this is what I think about that. This is the State Department. It's the U.S. government speaking. So you have to square that circle of real conversation, openness to other ideas, and some kind of discipline. What hasn't happened very much yet, but I would like to see it happen, is when the content of those conversations that we have becomes an integral part of our policy-making process. I mean policy in the sense of hard-nosed, what do you do about the pirates policy, or what do you do about the Middle East? And I think that will happen, but it hasn't happened yet. It's still kind of percolating along. Earlier last week, the State Department brought in to the administration brought into the department a new person in a new position. His name is Alec Ross, who is senior advisor for innovation and technology. And I think it's a sign of the commitment of the administration and now the State Department to look at what's going on out there in technology, for us particularly communication technology, but just across the board, and ask ourselves, how can we apply this to our mission? How can we make it possible for our employees to use it, always for a purpose, but to tap into their own creativity? So it's been a very busy and exciting time for us. One of the things we find out is that it never stops. Now it's Twitter, but tomorrow it'll be something else, Twitter plus two or something. And so you've simply got to create the ability to track this, participate, figure out what's worthwhile and what's not. We were on Second Life for a while. It's not really being cost efficient, we think. Maybe it'll come back. So you have to have some mechanism for evaluation through the whole process too. So for us it's a beginning game, but it's pretty exciting. And what I'm talking about is just our part of public outreach. The idea of using this technology for internal conversations is there too. We're very much part of those conversations too, the internal ones. So thanks.
Okay, great. Great. Well, thank you very much. And Karen, maybe you can go into the development sphere and talk about how you guys have been. I mean, even the advent of the Global Development Commons is an innovation in itself, so maybe we can hear a little bit about that. Thank you.
Great, thanks a lot. Yes, the Global Development Commons, first of all, is a part of the Office of Development Partners within USAID, the office that I head, and that office is focused on building partnerships to improve how we do our development business. And within that whole context, the Global Development Commons itself is a real innovation. It's a small unit, and our themes are connect, collaborate, and innovate. And in part, I will say the Global Development Commons is a reflection of the fact that the complexity of today's development issues are not ones that are easily addressed by one actor. And so, in general, the international development has been, the way in which it's done has been transformed and is much more based on the idea of collaboration. We also noted that there's a lot of development information that we create through our in our projects that other donors create, and there really is not and has not been a very good way for that information to sort of circulate and be shared. And so this came about as an effort to find ways to bring people together. And it has evolved over time and to focus on promoting innovation within the agency, but not innovation just for innovation's sake, and also to promote collaboration, but all geared to helping us improve the development outcomes that we're able to generate. And what we and this, I would say, is also consistent. The kind of what the Global Development Commons enables us to do in terms of collaboration, bringing more partners into the development effort, the ability to reach further than we generally can to very new partners that the agency has never dealt with, but more importantly, to reach down further within the countries that we're trying to assist. And our goal is to reach to our beneficiaries of our assistance and try to bring them in so that we're using some of the knowledge that they have, that so that development is done less to them, but with them as active partners. And although, you know, that's our has been our mantra for development, that we haven't really incorporated that as effectively as we can with some of the new tools. And it's also consistent with the general concept that exists today that, around aid effectiveness, which really focuses much more on making the countries, country systems, the individuals in countries much more of a part of the development process. So all of what we're geared to is really trying to enable us to do international development more effectively. And so what we've taken advantage of the fact is that there are a variety of tools out there. Many of them are available in the countries in which we work, particularly mobile phone technology. And there's also access of a variety of actors to the wide range of information that's out there. We've done some, I would say, for us, some very exciting things this year. One of the perhaps the most exciting thing we did this year was our Development 2.0 Challenge. And it really was the first ever, certainly for USAID, where we did an open online global challenge using mobile, asking people for their ideas using mobile technology to come up with solutions to development challenges that they identified, but the challenge was around the use of mobile technology. We had, 115 submissions. The parties had an opportunity, the online community had an opportunity to comment on the submissions and the submitters to improve them based on some of those comments. There were 6,000 votes online, which we were really very excited about. And what came out of that were a variety of applications developed by the submitters in health, agriculture, disaster management, and education, although many of them were around the issue of health. We awarded prizes, and what we're now working on is trying to incorporate those solutions into our development business, because we don't want it to just be a contest and, you know, have a great time, but ultimately our objective is to improve our development product, what we do. And so we're working with our missions to make them aware of of solutions that relate that may relate to their country that they may be able to adopt. We've engaged a consultant that is working with us to identify potential private partners, venture capitalists, and the like that may be interested in investing in some of these ideas. I think another benefit of the challenge was it definitely brought us into contact with a totally different community of partners than AID has largely dealt with, which is another exciting factor because frequently government agencies such as USAID, you know, it's viewed that we circulate the work among the just a small crowd. And this has really, really, really burst open those boundaries and has really provided an opportunity for a much larger universe and a much more diverse universe of people to interact with us. One of the participants, just to offer a little bit of comment of how they reacted, is that it also, the participants in the challenge said that it also brought them into contact with a much broader universe of people that they formed partnerships with, people that were interested in what they produced. So I think it's had a benefit on both sides of the House in terms of us and our contact as well as some of the participants. Another thing that we're working on within is something we're calling technology remixes for our USAID missions. And what we're doing is we're going in and with some pilot missions, we're looking at some of their projects that where it looks like we can improve the development outcomes by incorporating some particular solution, whether frequently it's around information technology that also addresses collaboration as well as transparency. One we're doing with our mission in Mexico that is enabling greater transparency. It's dealing with mango growers and a variety of information that relates to their product and the like and connecting them with microfinance institutions. And we're hoping that by making that information more available to those microfinance institutions that we can increase the likelihood that those farmers, those growers will be able to get access to microfinance because also the risk to those microfinance institutions will be lower because they know more about the potential borrowers. We're also working with USAID Liberia, and this is a collaboration involving the Liberian government, the Development Gateway Foundation, and ESRI. We're working with them to enhance an aid management platform to add in some capability that will enable some the linking of the GIS technology and some analytical information that will enable better decision making on infrastructure placements. So the idea is, you know, we're doing a couple of pilots. We plan to get the information out within the agency so that there's a potential that other missions may identify where a particular application may work for them, but also because we're trying to stimulate the idea of innovation within AID so other people have on their mind, well, maybe either this might work for me or, maybe I should be thinking about how innovation could be incorporated into my activity. Another activity is we have launched globaldevelopmentcommons.net. It's right now, it basically is what we call sort of a one-way push of information out that's providing information about innovative tools, links with organizations that involve in innovation and the like, projects. But we're hoping our goal is to make it more interactive so that it becomes a collaboration space for people that are interested in innovation related to development. The future things that we're hoping to do, the idea of the challenge has really caught on within the agency. A challenge for us, however, is how do we scale that up in terms of providing an efficient, an easy means for the agency to do that. But there's a lot of interest in it. But it does present the challenge of being able to, I think it was Beth mentioned, of being able to articulate what is the problem that you want people to focus their attentions to. So there's some things that we need to work on within the agency, but there's been a tremendous uptake on the idea of the challenges within the agency. We're also planning to do an innovation spring forum, we're looking to make that an online brainstorming session that's addressing some specific development issues. In terms of, I guess, some of the things that as we're trying to expand the idea of innovation and the application even of some of the things that we've already identified, we have noted that scaling up is a challenge, and that's one of the things that we're definitely looking at. And just how do we make this just an integral part of our business processes? We'll respond to some of the questions that have been posed. But I think that we're getting more attention within the agency. A challenge for us, however, has been our internal communications. That helps people see what this is doing is not just something being done because it's kind of interesting, but how this can enable us to do our development business more effectively, which ultimately is what it is. We're not doing it because it's fun. It is fun. But it really is because we believe that consistent with the whole idea of my office, which is around partnerships and leverage, that we're using tools that are out there to leverage what we, the U.S. government, can do so that we can get greater bang for the buck of what the U.S. government is investing in, but also what we've already invested in. One of the challenges, we've created a vast amount, we and other donors, actually, and other countries, have created a vast amount of development information, reports, analysis, and the like. But that information has not been very easily linked. And so there's even just a lot that can be gained from connecting people with stuff that is already out there, and that's part of what we see as our goal. So let me just stop there.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And thank you to all of the presenters for keeping to the time limit and being stimulating at the same time. I'd like to ask each of you a question, and then I'll open it to the floor. Maybe I'll start with you, Karen, to drill down a little bit more about some of the issues that you mentioned. I guess the challenge for involving national partners, beneficiaries, is not only language problems, but also potentially literacy problems. So maybe they don't speak English. Maybe we don't have people who speak those languages. How can we involve people in their own development in more considered ways than we've done so far? And then I guess a little bit more about what you just mentioned at the end about this connectivity question. Not only between USAID missions and headquarters, but also all your contracting implementing partners, and then across the international community. How can we promote greater linkages? And maybe that will be the next challenge that you pose online. I don't really know, but maybe you could just drill down a bit more in that area.
Yeah. Well, I think and some of these things, as we're proceeding with some of the implementation, we're discovering issues and we're kind of, you know, knocking down barriers as we go. The link with the beneficiary presents, I mean, there's innumerable challenges there. As I mentioned, the mobile technology has tended to be a very effective because everybody in the developing world seems to have a mobile technology. It's more of a challenge when you're sort of talking about broadband and things like that. Mobile technology, however, has some inherent strengths as well as weaknesses, so you have to deal with some of those sorts of things. But generally, frequently, if you're dealing with mobile technology within a particular country, the language issues aren't such an issue, obviously. It's more when they're sort of trying to access information that may reside elsewhere outside the country. But generally, first of all, I think a lot of those people that may be trying to do that have some facility with the language, and so it's not so much of an issue. But I think one of the barriers that we will have to grapple with is as we seek to reach as far down to beneficiaries in remote areas, and particularly in remote areas, and not just in the capitals, because that if you're just in the capitals, there's a certain segment that you're reaching, but there's a certain segment that you're not reaching. And so I think that what we will be doing is as we try to push this connection and collaboration further out toward those beneficiaries will have to grapple with some of those issues. How do you deal with the information? Maybe you're kind of interposing an intermediary. Maybe you're getting getting people that can serve in that role. But we haven't. I think that a lot of our focus has been around connecting existing development actors and so pushing it out all the way to the beneficiaries. We haven't grappled with all of that, but that is our goal. On the connectivity, do you mean from a technology standpoint,
like sharing experiences, as you mentioned earlier?
You know, the Global Development Commons, there's an aspect of what we do that is focused within the agency itself, and there's an aspect that's really sort of focused on engaging the outside world. What we're finding in terms of the outside world, let me just deal with that, is that there's a number of other actors, I will say to some degree, in islands here or there, that are after the same thing, because people realize that there really are just vast amounts of development information that's out there that has largely been inaccessible, or it's been difficult to collaborate. And so one of the things that we've been doing is to try to connect with those people. And when I say connect, some of it has just been to talk to them so we know what each other is doing. And part of the goal is to find ways to connect internally. One of the things is that AID is a tremendously decentralized organization with our field missions all over the place, with a lot of information and knowledge being created there. What we realized is that information that's and data analysis reports is created through our projects and our contractors isn't always easily accessible from the center or even from another mission. You may not even know it exists. And so that's been one of our goals as well internally for how AID functions itself, is to demonstrate to the agency the value of some of these techniques that allow us to use information we've created more efficiently, connect actors doing some of the same things. So we're trying to mirror inside the agency some of the innovative approaches that we're doing outside.
Okay, well, great. I'm sure some people in this room might have some ideas as well how to deal with some of these challenges. Jeremy, perhaps you could talk a bit about your own experience in working with the affected populations for the diplomacy side of things. Could we engage the Somali press in a debate about how to end piracy and get ideas from Somalis? How can we encourage Afghans to have a bigger discussion about ending corruption? There are some great examples in Afghanistan. How can we encourage cross-Afghan or intra-Afghan discussion? Is that something you think you can encourage in your job?
We can encourage it. For us, just as the USAID mission is sort of the retail element out in the field, the embassies are our retail outlets, and they have the ability to cross some of these communication gaps. But Afghanistan is a perfect example, because in the capital, you do have a literate population, and you have electricity. The farther you get out, the less of that there is, and you have large groups of important people who are not really literate. They don't have all this new technology, the new media. So how do you reach them? It's very labor-intensive, and yet you have to. I don't think we can do that from back here. And for some countries, maybe, but I think the individual solution has to be found in the individual country, shaped from our perspective by our embassy. We in Washington can support them, depending on what the particular goal is. We can help them with technology. Technology can help, but we can help them by articulating policy. What are our objectives? But they have to execute it on the ground. That's in fact a major issue for us, because we do run global websites, and much of that is translated literally and figuratively by our embassies onto their own websites. Mm-hmm. But we also run centralized websites in Arabic and French and Persian, Russian, Chinese. There's six altogether, as well as English. And that there the goal has been to pump out information about the United States. But now we're trying to engage with people out there. And it's very much a collaboration with our embassies and with people in the field. Mm-hmm. But we're about to start a blog in Chinese. Mm-hmm. So we will run it back here. It's like the ones we're doing in Arabic, for example. we'll run it back here, but we'll work it with the embassy and with the Chinese specialist in blogging, whom we know in Beijing. It's not quite true, I suppose, that every case is individual, but new technology, new media are not the answer to everything. And it all finally has to be localized, at least in communication.
Okay. Great. Well, Doug, maybe over to you, since NASA is probably more on the A-team side of innovation. I guess, what kind of technology transfer and information sharing have you tried to do so far to deal with some development and peace-building challenges? I suspect that most of your technology transfer has been with maybe, as you were saying, health and medicine and private sector advances. Have you thought at all about how some of the great advances and innovations you've had in-house could affect the two on my right here?
Yeah, and in fact, there are some examples where we're already working with USAID in Africa and in Central America. There's a project that we've done called Servir, which is Spanish for to serve. And it's using a lot of remote sensing technology that NASA has and also analytical tools to analyze resource issues to help mitigate potential disasters and floods and things like that. And that's been put in place in several countries, as I mentioned, in Central America and in Africa, and potential for many other applications as well. Some other technologies, here's an example where there's a lot of benefit for the developing world in providing clean water. And clean drinking water kills about 2 million people every year, most of them children, or dying from waterborne disease. And there's some technologies that NASA has developed, have flown on every space shuttle mission since the beginning, called the microbial check valve, which has been commercialized into systems that are being used now in remote villages around the world. And just one example, there are a group called Concern for Kids, which partnered with some engineers at Marshall Space Flight Center and has this technology on the flatbed of a pickup truck, and they go around to villages and provide clean drinking water when the villages don't have any otherwise, and put it in a container that will allow them to have clean drinking water for the next couple of weeks. And in one particular village in Iraq, there was 1 year before they were doing this where they lost 10 kids just in that village to waterborne disease, and they haven't lost a single child in that village since this was done. So that's just one example, but there's potential for that kind of technology to make its way and really make a difference in some of these locations.
Microbial check valve, does it just indicate that there's problems, or does it actually clean
it? It cleans the water. It's an iodine-based purification system, yeah.
Okay, let's just wait a second from the audience, if you don't mind. And thank you. And Beth, given what you've heard, perhaps you might even have some recommendations for some of the issues that have been raised earlier, and you might have some additional questions. I think they answered some of your questions earlier, but perhaps you might have something else to add here. What would you do going forward to solve some of these issues?
Well, let me state first of all that we are just at the beginning of a process that really has to be characterized primarily by listening and by learning. So I have no answers to bring to the conversation, or no definitive answers to bring to the conversation, especially when we've just heard these compelling and exciting examples, very specific examples that demonstrate how real work is being done in practice. I think, surely what I'm hearing is that there are, and what I've seen from conversations over the last many months and in the many years of work that I've done in this field leading up to this point, the kinds of work that is getting done, and that's getting done often in spite of rather than because of the culture of government, a culture where we really need to do as much as we can to signal the importance and the acceptance of innovation, the desire for, it's funny, I've been teaching the last 2 years out at Stanford, and in California, there is a culture in which if you haven't failed at a startup, you have to fail at a company in order to be somebody. Everybody exchanges, which startup failed most recently? And it's kind of a badge of honor to have a company that failed. That's very different than the culture of Washington, in which, for very good reason, because of the public trust with which of which we are the stewards, we cannot afford to fail. And yet, the only way that we improve the way we work is through trial and error and through experimentation by trying new things. So there is, I think, an enormous cultural chasm to be overcome of bringing some of that fearlessness of failure, if you will, into the culture of government so that we are trying new innovations. And there are clearly people who are doing it, who are trying it, who get it. And it's not just Twittering or things that involve new media or new technologies, but I think very centrally it's about new processes and new practices. And first and foremost, I think it begins with it doesn't begin with the acceptance of Twitter. I have to say my 80-year-old mother is Twittering right now. She's probably watching this right now. Hello. And she's blushing now out in cyberspace. I can feel it from here. But it really starts with a change of attitude and one that is centrally about trust and about believing in the expertise and experience of the people on the other side of that membrane, on the other side of that institutional boundary, and recognizing that there is a need to work together in addressing these challenges. So when you talk about the examples of working with people on the ground in China to start a blog or working with collaborators, whether in the private sector or people in other countries to address development challenges or the tremendous work that you're doing with private sector companies, I think it's really just inspiring because what it signals is an openness and a willingness to listen and a recognition that we don't have all the answers sitting here. And so I think first and foremost, the work that we do, and it's a work that has to be owned really by everybody, is about coming to terms with and accepting and viewing as a badge of honor, if you will, the importance of collaboration, the importance of trust in others, the importance of recognizing that all the answers aren't within the boundaries. So that kind of clearance culture. I'm coming from an academic culture now into the clearance culture, which I think is really the pervasive norm to a large extent. I think you sort of really encapsulated it well when you talked about sort of moving from that clearance culture into what you call controlled chaos, coherent chaos, excuse me. Maybe it is controlled chaos is the interim step into coherent chaos is the next step we don't know what will come next. So it's really about making that change happen. And so there's no, I don't think there's a panacea or there's a single recipe or a single policy. I think the answer is the fact that we have to address this through culture, through policy, through legislation, through technology, and all of these efforts really working in tandem. And the more specific we can be, the kind of more of these stories that we get out and we talk about and exchange and create the mechanisms for exchanging best practices, I think that's the best thing that people like me can do, which is to be the curator and the celebrator and the, you know, yippee of these causes. That's a term of art, of course. Is to really celebrate this work that's being done and to encourage more of it and to really hold up as champions the kind of people who are succeeding. The other thing I think that we can really do is introduce the metrics and to really consistently hold our feet to the fire. As Karen has said, to make sure that what we're doing is trying to not, I mean, I think fun is crucial and key, but to ensure that what we're doing is designed to achieve a goal and that we're constantly asking ourselves, are we achieving these goals through the new methods? Is Twitter helping us to achieve our goals? I do think fun helps us to achieve those goals, to create the kind of engagement that we care about, to get people to participate in this very, very hard work, and to do it for the joy of doing it, because we know that we don't go into government for the salaries. So it's really getting more people engaged because they want to be but doing things in a way that really works, figuring out what works, communicating that and constantly replicating and evolving in what we're doing. So I'm sorry, that was a complete non-answer to a question. But it really is a pep talk because I'm inspired by what I'm hearing here.
Great. Well, thank you. Now I'd like to open it to the floor. We have two microphones, I think, over there, and Lizzie has one over there. Can you introduce yourself? Can you keep your questions short? If you want to address one of the speakers, please ask a speaker or just to the panel. Please.
Great, thanks. My name is Tim Donaghy. I'm with the Union of Concerned Scientists. And my question, I guess, is for Mr. Curtin and maybe a little bit for Dr. Novak. The phrase that stuck in my mind from your presentation was, let my people go. And I'm really interested in learning a little bit more about that from you. Like, how is that possible? Is it mostly a legal barrier? Is it a cultural barrier? And also, how far can you push it without sort of compromising what the State Department does? And just to give you a little bit of context, my interest is primarily in scientists in the federal government. And I think in a lot of places like NASA, you know, there have been problems in the past, but I think there's a culture that the scientists should be allowed to speak freely, particularly about their research, and that if you don't allow them to do that, you're kind of missing out on why it's important to have scientists in the government at all. So I am just sort of interested in hearing a little bit about what that means in the State Department and what your thoughts on it are. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Let's take a few questions. I think we have one up here in the front row, and then this gentleman here. So this guy first. Yeah.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. What has your experience been in holding meetings online with the people you're trying to get to participate in this?
Great question.
Hi, my name is Bodin Contour, and I work at the Library of Congress, and I have a question about intellectual property and copyright. And I'm in the IT department, and I know we can liberate the data, but we do have data at the Library of Congress, authority records and others, that are copyrighted. And it's by law. And I know State Department with... the outreach program with the website. I mean, we can release this data to Americans, but not overseas. And I know the State Department, they can release data overseas, but not to Americans, you know, based on these regulatory...
Okay, great. Thank you. That's a great question. One more over here, please. And then two more, and then Seema, you next. Okay.
Thanks for all of your comments. My name is Max Bruner. I'm with the Bloom and Bruner Company, and we connect and invest in early-stage startup companies, mostly out of California and also D.C., to government. Most of them are clean tech and IT companies. So I guess my question is, how do I more effectively connect them directly to your departments? If they have a team of software engineers in Mountain View, California, has a great idea or a great piece of code that could make your website more usable, your information more accessible, how do I get a meeting with one of you or get that idea to you? Or what's the process to compete with other companies that are doing that same kind of thing? And also, how do I know what your needs are so that I can go out and search for entrepreneurs who can solve those problems?
Great question. Thanks. Okay, Seema here in the front row, and then we'll go to the panel, and we'll open up again so you can think of other questions.
This is a little unfair because I know all the speakers up here and I've spoken to them before. So I'm going in with, I'm Seema Patel, I work at the Global Development Commons with Karen. And my question is how do we learn from each other? One of the first things that we did when we started thinking about challenges and prizes was to head over to NASA and to Doug and say, how did you guys do this? You're so much further ahead of us. What kind of legal challenges did you face? And we found that NASA had gone through a number of steps to get legislative authority to do prizes, and now we're all kind of trying to follow the same footsteps. How can we let one agency's successes be a success for the entire government?
You forgot to say I am now on leave as a professor of intellectual property from New York Law School. I'm off duty. Let me look at the list of questions here. Great questions, and let me see if I can briefly speak to some, if not all of them. There is a parallel effort going on being led out of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, my home institution, on science integrity, that's going on in parallel. And it's not, I think, accidental that there's thinking about both open government and science integrity happening at the same time, since issues about how we get scientific expertise into decisions, how we protect the First Amendment rights of scientists, how we protect whistleblowers who are from the scientific community all at the same time. These sets of issues are really, I think, of parallel importance. But they also demonstrate, as does the question about liberating the data, that these are that the idea of transparency and openness or engagement are not simple. It's not just a matter of saying, let's liberate all the data and put it online, or let's let everybody talk about anything anytime they want to. Because the issue of it's interesting. This came up in a meeting. I was looking at a wonderful new website that's being developed by an agency that's very interactive and highly participatory and very conversational, in which it was also very unclear who was the voice that was speaking on the website. And one of the comments that came up from someone in the audience in this presentation was, well, people have certain expectations about what they want a .gov voice to say or speak. And so I think coming to some understanding about the different contexts, that has been used a lot of ways to create that culture of clearance and the fact that you cannot blog and you can't Twitter and you can't do this, which we see changing now. But finding those new, creating that new culture and that new etiquette, which are the contexts in which it is appropriate to speak and with what voice, which is not to say what's happening in a lot of places is, of course, on the, whether it's on the science front or on the data front, is figuring out the right answer in the right context. I think the answer is that there isn't one answer for one for every single context. In other words, one can speak in a .gov capacity and speak in a personal capacity. One can liberate certain kinds of data in one way and not in other ways and come to understandings about how we do that. These are such complex questions. I'm giving just very cursory answers to this, but I think the questions both highlight the fact that what we need is a process and an ongoing commitment to these set of issues and these set of principles that get us, hopefully, to useful answers. Part of that means also coming back to something that we sort of talked about earlier is doing a better job of articulating the questions so that we can have a conversation about these hard questions and what the answers are. One of those hard questions are, how do we articulate the questions such that we can get, whether it's volunteer software development or commercial software development, in terms of what you're doing, you should take a look. I think maybe someone from DoD Techopedia may be in the room and may be able to talk to the ways in which they have done wonderfully innovative things in communicating what their needs are better so that people can develop new technologies, can build their businesses around what the needs of government actually are, and to do so in a transparent way. But we need to do a lot more at sort of articulating what the needs are openly so that we can generate both economic development opportunities, work for your company and your returns on your investment, but also volunteer and civic engagement opportunities for the many, many, many people who would like to participate in government, not simply by filing a comment on a rulemaking, but maybe also by writing a piece of code. And I think that's a very difficult and unexplored new frontier that we will need to engage with.
Great, super. Okay, Doug, you have a few questions for you. Do you remember them?
Yeah, I think so. one in particular, the question about, you know, how do we connect with ideas that we may have, and we have you're based in Silicon Valley. NASA has a research center there, Ames Research Center, and like I mentioned, there are innovative partnership offices at all 10 of the field centers, and you can go to our website ipp.nasa.gov and contact the IPP chief at each of the centers. So if you're interested in partnering with any NASA center, the IPP chief at the center is a great conduit to go to and connect you with, you know, the appropriate people at that center for the things that you may be interested in. Or, of course, you can contact me, and then I'll just send you to them. in terms of understanding... Oh, I'm sorry. I haven't got the technology down here. In terms of understanding what some of our requirements are, we put together a significant document every year in our solicitation for small business innovation research where we document a number of topics and subtopics in some detail that lay out what NASA's looking for, and we work closely with all of our mission directorates to identify where they have technology gaps. So, and all the federal agencies that conduct significant amounts of R&D conduct an SBIR program and document their needs, so that's a very good source to go and see what some of the needs are. Even if you're not going to be submitting an SBIR proposal, it gives you an idea of where some of the needs and the technology gaps that the agencies may have.
But maybe, Doug, I think Seema's question was also, how do you make sure that everyone doesn't reinvent the wheel every time they jump into this space, so that whatever you learned as you were opening up your systems to innovation and competitions and all that, mm-hmm. is there a way to share that so that they can expedite the process next time?
Yeah, and like you came by, we do meet with a lot of other agencies, and I mentioned the process we went through with Ocean Tomo in doing the auction for the first time. And we weren't actually selling government IP there. We were selling exclusive rights to license the government IP. But we go to different forums and conferences and talk about what we did and try to educate folks that way. We have agencies coming in and meeting with us and explaining the kind of things that, that we've done. The question about how do we, once somebody's blazed a path, how can you open it for all of the government? That may be a question for Congress, and there are, you know, many different committees that have different jurisdictions, and getting them all to think in unison may be a challenge. It took NASA several years to get the authority that we have for our prize competitions. And we initially determined that we could have a limited authority under the necessary expense doctrine for small prizes, but needed to get specific authority for the larger prizes that we do. And although we don't have the funding in our recent authorization bill, the Congress just raised the ceiling that we have to get specific congressional approval for up to $50 million for prizes. And
great. Okay. Before I turn it to Jeremy and Karen, I forgot to remind everyone that if you stay till the end, there's a reception to follow. So there's an incentive here to stay through the question and answer. Okay. So, Jeremy, perhaps you can talk about meetings online, the success of that, if you have that. And maybe I think your Library of Congress question still hasn't been fully resolved. Do you think you could address those, Jim?
Yeah. Let me talk also about the first question, which is about creating a situation where your staff can execute their own ideas. And there are regulatory barriers that affect what we do, but there's also gaps. There are gaps in our regulations, especially when it comes to some of this new media stuff. So for us, it's a combination of working very closely with our own staff, knowing what they're doing, and having a clear chain of command, but at the same time creating a sense among the staff that if they come up with a good idea, we'll give them a chance to explore it. If it's relevant, obviously, because not all ideas are good. We have to get used to living with a certain amount of risk, and it can be risk of several forms. Some of it's just financial. You start something and it doesn't work. Some can be tremendous embarrassment because you're working out there on the Internet. There's no net in Internet. You say something, it's global, and it's eternal. And so you have to create an understanding in your staff that if they do something wrong, you'll protect them. I can go into examples, but I'd rather not. It's a question of trust with your staff and relationship between yourself and the staff and the people you work for. It does require a change in culture. I think state is moving that way. Often, especially with some of the trickier questions, progress is slow. But I think we're making good progress in letting our people realize if they're out there talking about policy, for example, you know, we'll protect them if they get something a little bit wrong. The online meetings, we have had town hall meetings. I think they're fairly successful. A lot of them for us depend on the ability of our embassies to drag people in or attract them to these programs. But that's important in many ways because the relationships they have with the people in the country, that's an important function, and technology can help them do that. Mm-hmm. Just putting up a web chat on the web, we can attract several hundred people, but if you're talking about a global audience, that's not a lot. So we're still working on that, which, of course, involves metrics, and it's not only collecting the metric, but it's establishing a standard. And for some kinds of activities, several hundred people is a good rate of participation. For others, if you're not doing millions, you're not doing your job. I don't think we as a government, and in some ways I think private sector suffers from the same thing. We don't really have good metrics for a lot of online stuff. In the government, we have a particular problem because we're not allowed to collect personal information. If we do, unless people volunteer it, but if we put up a program, we don't do cookies. We're not allowed to do cookies. We can't trace where people come. How many people from this program aimed at Iran are from Iran? Mm-hmm. Well, we can guess from the URLs and so on, but we don't really know. That's a challenge. There are regulations like that. Mm-hmm. Privacy, archiving, and security are the big areas of regulation that bother us. and straight business, you know, inside internal remote conferencing. We use digital video conference, but more and more we use this Connect system, this Adobe Connect, because it doesn't take a lot of bandwidth. It's much more flexible than a digital video conference, and mm-hmm. you can have more participants.
Great. All right, Karen, I'm not sure if there's anything left, but you probably have something to add at this stage.
Well, I was just going to add on, two things. One is, you know, how do we learn from one another? I think one of the things we haven't really sort of talked about, but internally I know we learn from one another and within the agency, and I think that in addition to sort of the you know, kind of ad hoc outreach that we could potentially benefit in terms of driving, the concept of innovation within the U.S. government of having some sort of network. I mean, so that, and I think the kind of information technology sorts of tools that we have can potentially sort of facilitate both across agencies as well as within agencies of having sort of a network of innovators that are feeding off of one another. Mm-hmm. And so we, because I think also that if it's been done at another agency, I mean, even though we have different rules, it suggests at least it's in the realm of the possible. But I think the idea that ultimately it's probably going to mean engaging Congress is out there, because, you know, we can go agency by agency by agency by agency to modify our rules, but I think that there are some things that are applicable across the government that would warrant really engaging Congress. And ultimately, because they are related to our core missions, indicating how this will benefit government efficiency. The other thing I would just sort of say in terms of this gentleman's question over here is, you know, how does someone that's really interested in connecting with government agencies, the USAID, we have a unit, Public-Private Partnership Division, Global Development Alliance, which is another part of my office that does that, a lot of agency procurements and the like are put online and are easy enough. But I think a lot of the challenges and other things that are, again, online and open generally. So I think that there's a variety of tools that are out there that are geared toward bringing in folks exactly like the community that you mentioned.
Great. Thank you. Well, let's go to another round of questions. I saw two hands over here, and then I think Lizzie has some questions from our web streaming, so we have to see what people outside are saying. So in the second row and then in the back, can we do those two first? And then Lizzie, can I look at those? Well,
good afternoon. My name is Kessie Stribling, and I'm a CEO of a company here in D.C., KSG Strategic Consulting. But I'm primarily here as the founder of 100 Days In, connecting stakeholders to the change we need, which is an initiative to get businesses, entrepreneurs, nonprofits, and community leaders connected to the government and really being able to create some proactive strides to responding to the change that we need. I've heard a few examples of ways that you're moving forward to raise awareness about what you're doing. Dr. Curtin, you talked about town hall meetings. Ms. Turner, you talked about creating a network. I'm wondering, with all the wonderful projects that you have here where you are connecting with your constituents, is there an initiative on the horizon to have multi-government agency collaboration to do a PSA or public awareness campaign to let folks know, number one, the great work that you're doing, to the innovation that comes out of it, and three, most important, being able to link them to upcoming projects. Thank you.
Okay, great. And then, thanks.
Hi, my name is Annette Brown. I'm with Chemonics International. I want to pick up on something that Gail said, which is that innovation is not always about Twitter and Facebook, but also sometimes about processes and approaches and systems. And I think that that's important to remember. I think it's true in our government, but where I work in development, it's certainly true. There's so much room in development for innovation still that's not about technology. And I worry sometimes with all the excitement around the technology innovations that we ask the question, how can I do this with mobile phones, rather than just how can we do this better? What's the best way to approach this challenge? And so with the Global Development Commons, it's clear to me that the idea is how can we use technology to promote collaboration and innovation. But what has been less clear is whether it's how can we use technology to promote innovation using technology, or whether it's how can we use technology to promote all kinds of innovations and development. So my first question to Karen is sort of which is it? And if it's the latter, promoting all kinds of innovation, I'm curious whether you're planning any challenges around non-technology-based innovations, dare I say it, or other activities to make sure that we are also promoting, not one or the other, but that we're continuing to promote the kind of innovative thinking that we need to be doing in development that's not just about Twitter and mobile phones.
Thank you. Annette's also an expert in innovation, so I think people should cluster to her during the reception period. And I think it's very important to think through the no-tech through to the high-tech means. So we don't have to just worry if people have a cell phone or access to the Internet, but maybe the tea house or the radio. Most people listen to the radio no matter what kind of technology access they have. Let me read a few questions, and I'll just let you all decide which ones you want to answer. So we have one from San Francisco. About listening to the public and integrating ideas, how are agencies aggregating this information and using it to inform strategic decision-making? Someone else is asking about risk-taking and how you can incentivize risk-taking behavior. I think some of you have thought about that. Related to the first question is not only aggregating information and making it available, but also using it to inform decision-making. How can you tell when you're actually bringing in outside? Would it make sense to say, this is an idea we got from, the North Pole, and we're really excited? And are you going to make available your performance metrics to the public? I assume you will, because everything is about transparency and openness, right, in this new government. So let's start, Beth, let's start with you. So I think some of the questions were addressed to you.
Thank you. Let's see if they're... some number of good interventions. Let me start with one of the ones that came in online. How do agencies aggregate information and use it to inform decision making? So I've had some experience working over the last several years with the United States Patent and Trademark Office on developing a program called Peer to Patent, in which we've created a social network that connects volunteer scientists and technologists to the patent office to inform patent examination practices, in which there's a highly structured, very well-defined process that solicits specific kinds of information relevant to the patent examination process. So what's interesting about, in particular, it's been quite a successful process, small pilot project that's now in its second year, which was recently expanded to a wider area from high-tech into also the business method patent area. But what's interesting about it is that it's a way in which we articulated the questions very clearly and elicited useful feedback that was directly relevant to policymaking. We know that because we've actually polled and surveyed the examiners, in which we actually know what information that they used and what was provided by the public and what was useful to informing either information that they couldn't have found themselves, the government officials, or information that informed their own research and determination. So I think that there are lots of different contexts, whether it's areas in which one needs to gather specific information, areas in which one needs help with analyzing information, finding gaps, finding holes, engaging in drafting processes, depending on, again, what the desired outcome is and what's sought in terms of result or generating innovative solutions along the lines of what some of these prize initiatives have done to major social challenges. I think there are ways in which we can design the process to ensure that the information that we elicit is actually directly useful to the process. So I agree that when you have a very open-ended online meeting, it's often hard to see how is that information actually getting used unless there is someone who says, the comment from the North Pole was extremely helpful, and we need to do more of that feedback. But we also need to be doing more to design the practices in ways in which people know what information is needed and therefore know what information they need to contribute. So I think that there's use to both kinds of ways of doing things, the sort of open-ended, give us your ideas, which is very important to sort of moving the culture forward to more openness and to brainstorming new ideas and coming up with things that we would never think of if we were only confined to what we knew to ask. At the same time, by asking more, and there are contexts in which that's already taking place, we get information that we know we're using, that we know is directly useful. And it's done every day, of course, in whether it's been done for many years in contexts like rulemaking, in which since 1946 the government has invited public comment in regulatory rulemaking through the 975 or so advisory committees that are constituted around the government to provide direct and targeted forms of expertise to agencies. So it's just about really scaling up and doing more of that in which we're articulating the problem and therefore getting information that's really useful back in to inform the way we make decisions. And this finally just gets to the comment, which I think was the very useful suggestion of the public service announcement, is the more we articulate the challenge, the better we're going to link up people to the problems, the more you have folks like NASA actually saying, here's what we're trying to do, and brainstorming ideas, it creates the business opportunities and the volunteer opportunities that you're talking about, and I think it's a wonderful suggestion and one that we need to take seriously about how we do more of that. So I think I'll stop.
Comment first on the question about multi-agency collaboration and how do we share best practices and communicate and so on. I think there's some organizations in place that can do that, and one in particular with regard to the agencies that do R&D is the Federal Laboratory Consortium, or the FLC, and John Amond, who's here from my office, he's the NASA rep working with the FLC, but that's a network of all federal laboratories. And it was established by Congress, and there's a lot of sharing of best practices and so on. And so use of existing organizations and networks like that could be leveraged to provide a conduit for sharing some of these things and lessons learned and, you know, trying out some new things for a very broad-based community. And that organization celebrates successes and has awards and things like that. So perhaps, you know, working in some of the new technologies and trying to get recognition for some of that through that kind of mechanism might be a good thing to do. Another thought on how do we encourage and incentivize? I think celebrating success is huge, and we need to make sure that people are aware when we have successes. And, you know, the example of somebody from the North Pole, well, there may be lots of people from the North Pole with great ideas, but until somebody else from the North Pole had their idea recognized, they said, well, why should I bother? Nobody's going to listen to me. Likewise, in an agency, somebody might say, well, nobody from the North Pole is going to have a good idea until they hear that somebody from the North Pole does, and then they say, well, next time somebody from the North Pole knocks on my door, I'm going to listen. You know, so you got to sort of celebrate and create momentum and make people aware that and open to receiving good ideas from the outside. And in terms of the risk tolerance and the acceptance of failure, you know, I think that's something that's very important. And we've dealt with that in NASA in terms of the kind of things that we try to do. And in setting up the COTS program that I mentioned, where there's no guarantee that you're going to have success, so you've got to have sort of backup plans until you can ensure success. If you put high-risk things on the critical path, that you could have, you know, a huge train wreck if you have a problem. You have to, in some cases, maybe start out at the margins on some of these innovations and do things that may not be in the critical path, but you can prove that they work and prove success, and then they can migrate more towards the critical path. And I know in industry they've learned some hard lessons with that. I think one was the new Coke that Coca-Cola did a while back. And so typically industries will try new products sort of at the margins, and then if they're successful, then migrate them to their, you know, their mainline activities. And so I think we have to learn to be tolerant of failure on those things and be mindful of the responsibilities that the government has for being responsible stewards of the taxpayer dollars and not, you know, taking unacceptable risks.
Great. Thank you. Jeremy, do you have anything to add?
Just to comment that in terms of sharing things with the American people, our bureau is under a restraint because there's legislation saying we're not allowed to talk to the American people. The Smith-Mundt legislation from 1953, it started with U.S. Information Agency. So And we're not allowed to use our funds to give information, theoretically even about ourselves, to Americans. It's a bit of a drawback. It means we don't have a constituency, for example, and so when we go up to the Hill, we can't say, you know, we're building my aircraft carrier in your district. But so it's just, it's a constraint. And the Internet changes the whole dynamic, though. You can't have an Internet program and then say Americans can't watch it. It just doesn't work. So we're still working through some of the legal implications of all that. Then as far as incentivizing risk, that is something we work on all the time. We do it through rewards or encouraging people, showing people around the Bureau what this means for them when their colleagues do it. And then, as I said earlier, if somebody's not successful, then you protect them if you need to, but you don't punish them at any rate.
Karen, did you want to add?
There was a specific question about, you know, is this innovation of principally information technology, or does it relate more broadly? And it's really the latter. And I think one of the things that we had to really make clear, because when the Global Development Commons initially was created, I think that the message was about information technology, and I think people understood it to be information technology, which it really isn't. I would say that Global Development Commons really is about innovation that enables us to deliver a better development product in effect. And some of the innovations are around information technology. Some information technology assists us in bringing people together to talk about solutions, but it is not it is not about information technology. It really is a means to an end. I think that someone else also mentioned about making available performance metrics, and I think that this is really a very interesting piece to this whole thing, because I think one of the things that we're grappling with as we try to define the results we propose to deliver for the resources that are being given to us is, how do you measure that? How do you measure sort of success in innovation? How do we capture that? And that's one of the things that we're really sort of grappling with, and I think that that's something that within U.S. government agencies, that would be something useful to share as well. How do you measure innovation? But also, how do you, and this relates to the whole idea of changing the culture, also in measuring it. And we obviously do want to measure success, but it is important that there is an element of risk-taking that is involved. And how do we define the space of our operations, in the case, and I'm speaking of USAID in this particular instance, where we're in a space where risk taking is perhaps valued even more highly than is more appropriate for that space. How do we help people understand that and appreciate that? And also, how do we incentivize? I think a large part of it is around recognition, celebrating success. Awards. That's something that we're thinking about trying to create a special agency award around innovation. But I think this whole thing of performance metrics is a big piece that needs to be looked at closely.
Great. Well, thank you. I think what I'd like to do now is actually use this opportunity to thank all the speakers. I think we'll end a little bit early so that we have time for networking. We have one more question from the Internet. Okay, Lizzie has forced me for one more question, but I think I guess we'll have to answer it online. We can't answer it. I'd like to give the opportunity to people to informally network. So go ahead, Lizzie. Okay, you want to read that?
This is coming from a participant in Singapore who is up at 4:30 a.m.
Wow. And so we
felt that we had to ask it. to what extent is the U.S. government willing to share or even promote mechanisms and metrics relating to this open government project to other countries specifically? If so, how might this happen, considering how such a project may necessarily go beyond technical assistance and those countries' unique political sensitivities?
All right, I think, Beth, you are it.
Wow, the last word between you and the coffee break. I will be brief, since you should be in bed in Singapore at 4:30 in the morning. And I have had the great pleasure of traveling to Singapore several times, and where they are doing amazingly interesting, I think, and innovative work, particularly in the way they engage in knowledge sharing. It is a very different size of government than what we have here. But I do think that the international collaboration is a very important piece of this. Is one of the first things that I did upon arriving here was to participate in a conference call with international CIOs from around the world. My colleague Vivek Kundra, who of course chairs the CIO Council, is also actively engaged in conversations with other government officials. We've spoken recently to the Tom Watson's office in the UK, the so-called Ministry of Transformation in the UK. So very much interested in engaging in that dialogue. I think the question of how we do that most effectively, related to the question of how we communicate challenges better and how we articulate the public service announcement, as you're talking about, is I think one of the things that we need to develop as we develop a process and a set of recommendations and an online presence for the work that we are doing, but ensuring that that conversation is global. It does take place to some extent now through organizations like the web managers and webmasters of government of internationally, through the CIOs. But again, it tends to be typically either on the technology side or the communication side rather than particularly on the policy-making innovation side. So I think it's probably an open opportunity for some ripe conversation conferences, particularly in pretty and tropical places, and dialogues so that we don't do everything exclusively with online meetings, but to really open this up as a more global discussion. So I'm delighted that we have participation from around the world because there's a lot to be learned from around the world in terms of innovations that are taking place, whether on the policy side or in terms of practices and in terms of technologies that are being used to great effect in many places. So we have a lot to learn just from our folks. You know, we're down the street from each other. We need the ways to learn to talk better with each other, and now the village is, of course, global. So I think there is no restriction on that conversation. This is about open government, and that means open and transparent, participatory, engaged with as wide a community as we can so that what we're doing is making the best possible policy in the public interest and bringing democracy into the 21st century.
Thank you. I think actually Karen has a final word now. So.
Well, I just wanted to add to that because I think we have seen some of our projects that we're doing with some of the developing countries using some of these techniques. Not only are they an opportunity to achieve a particular development result for our project, but in demonstrating the technique and in promoting the success of that, it in and of itself helps spread the word in some of those countries in which we work about the value of using these processes, the value of using open processes and collaborative processes, bringing people in to a process. So I think we're focused more on the sort of the developing countries, but we find that our ability to incorporate an approach, a collaborative approach into our projects in a country helps us carry that message about the value of open collaboration. So we get a dual benefit.
Great. Well, let me thank the Global Development Commons again, Seema, Lizzie, Karen, and others here for helping us to put together this really rich rich and interesting seminar. Thank you also to my colleagues, Justine, Shannon, and Mark, for helping out here. And, of course, thanks very much to all of our speakers here today for participating.